So it's the great privilege of the Reitz Israel Kollel Visiting Shir Committee, which has been established 5769. We are no longer in formation. To welcome Dr. Marvin Schick. Dr. Marvin Schick is a musmach of the Rabbi Jacob Joseph School in Staten Island, in Lower East Side, which is now in Staten Island. It has four campuses, four buildings.
Shuvdol is
in Edison, New Jersey. He was the assistant to the mayor Lindsay and all that stuff. He's the publisher of the rabbi of the Journal of Holocaust Memory Society and the RJJ Journal, which Dr. Schick doesn't like when I call it that. And it's our great privilege for him to speak on a number of topics. He could pick either of them, either from Satmar to Central to .. or what Satmar can learn from modern Orthodox educational institutions and what modern Orthodox educational institutions can learn from Satmar, how to cut the overhead in all these different institutions, or really whatever else Dr. Schick would like to talk about.
Well, I'm happy to be here, in large measure because Menachem is such a wonderful person, and it's always good to be with him, and it's difficult to say no to him. But also because even though this is obviously a small group, it's people who will have a lot to say about the Jewish future, especially those of you who turn to the United States. It's a fact of life that those of you who remain in Israel will have the blessing of living in Israel. But since everything that is man-made is dialectical, it was only HaKadosh Baruch Hu could you say Tov V'Tov Ma'od, but by human exertion, every blessing has a kind of difficult side, the dialectic, for example, of friendship. It's only your friends who really cause you agita. Enemies don't ask things of you. So the dialectic here is that if you're living in Israel, you have the bracha of living in Israel. But the other side of the coin is that there's a far diminished opportunity to really make a mark in terms of what one will do. You don't have the synagogue situation that you have, the shul situation you have in America, where the rub of a single shul can have an impact. You don't have even the school arrangement. There are some, in a sense, private yeshivot and day schools. Most of them are family affairs. So you don't have the ability to have a great impact. But again, you're living in Israel. But for those of you who return to whether the United States or Canada or elsewhere, in the diaspora, the situation is markedly different. And great, great opportunities for people to achieve, to use their talents and commitment to make a difference. One of the things that Menachem mentioned in the what I might speak about deals with this configuration referred to as modern Orthodox. Now you look around this group and you say modern Orthodox? Well, you know, in my youth, modern Orthodox meant modern, and that was the emphasis, and Orthodox was a tail to the term modern. Indeed, if you go back to the 40s and 50s and into the 60s, in shuls that were labeled modern Orthodox, a significant proportion of the people who davened in those shuls were not Shomer Shabbos. They were marginally Orthodox. They were Orthodox by identification. They were there because that's where they had been raised. They were mitzvah there. Their families identified with the shuls, but they weren't. Back in 1962 or 63, Charles Liebman, who was possibly the most outstanding sociologist of Judaism in the recent period, did an article in the American Jewish Yearbook on modern Orthodoxy, and he just indicated this was a vanishing breed. There were people who just, they were members as modern Orthodox. At that time, interestingly enough, Liebman and I were colleagues at YU. And it seems almost indecent for a person to be sitting here and saying that he taught at YU College in 1962. God, it seems like 62, 38, almost a half century ago. Wow. That's incredible. I must be old. But at any rate, to go back to the term modern Orthodox, it's a term that's used, and it's used, of course, often in reference to Yeshiva University. Rabbi Lamb always emphasized to me that he preferred the term centrist Orthodox, you know, possibly because it would indicate that Yeshiva would have an impact on a far greater portion of the Orthodox community than if it was simply modern. But I think there was something deeper there, and that is a desire to transcend the ordinary expectations of what modern Orthodox might bring to bear. But whether we identify it as modern Orthodox or centrist Orthodox or in another way, we're all religious Jews, we're all Orthodox Jews. And the point that I want to make to this group, and I think I made it a couple of years ago when I spoke to Kola Elion at Rabbi Lamb's request. I think every month or so he has a speaker in his office and about 30 fellows, and it's a rather impressive group of people who are in that, whatever the Kola is called. I think it's called Kola.
The Wexner Kola,
yeah. Is that, to an extent, we're trapped by these labels. We're trapped by them. They were given down to the previous generations. They were accepted in previous generations. They're in the literature. Dozens and dozens of studies and books and articles refer to modern Orthodox, Haredi Orthodox, Yeshiva World Orthodox, centrist Orthodox, ultra Orthodox, which is the way to distinguish the Yeshiva World and the Hasidim from guys like you. We're stuck with that. Indeed, as we meet here, I'm in the midst of a census of the yeshivas and day schools in America, something I do every 5 years. It's,
can you just say the statistic about Satmar?
I'll get to that. And it's a very difficult undertaking because the schools are small and they come and go. There are about 800-900 schools in the United States alone. And 40% of all yeshivas and day schools, by yeshivas I don't mean but the majority, but I mean elementary schools and high schools, have 100 or fewer students, which is a remarkable statistic. But anyway, in the study that I'm conducting now, I use the terms modern Orthodox, centrist Orthodox, Chabad and system being a different category, perhaps living up to the already trite aphorism that it's the religion closest to Judaism. Whether it is or not, it is by far the most significant movement in world Jewry today. Nothing comes close to it. I mean, you travel the world. So I use the terms, and I'm trapped by them, and some of them I don't like. About a month ago or less, actually, when the Madoff scandal broke, the Times, New York Times, had an article about a woman named Sonia Cohen from Vienna, who was the principal owner of a bank called the Medici Bank, which lost a ton of money in the Madoff mess. And this is a front page New York Times article. Please sit down. I feel uncomfortable. The front page New York Times article has Sonia Cohen, and they twice referred to her as ultra-Orthodox. Well, she traveled the world, made Arab sheikhs, you know, got investments from there. The same day, in the business section, they had a story of a far wealthier, a once wealthier person from Germany, perhaps the leading industrialist in Germany, who had committed suicide. No identity given of the person's religiosity. Several days later, they had a picture of the family coming back from services We don't know what church. But the Times is stuck with the idea of ultra-Orthodox. The Jewish Week, for which I write, some strange column, is kind of stuck with it, although I think now they finally agree with me to pull it back and they'll have fervently Orthodox. But it's all strange, we're trapped. The Orthodox population in the United States is probably around 600,000, maybe 700,000. It's hard to figure out exact numbers. The Orthodox are less likely to, in my judgment, to respond to surveys than others, particularly see them. So there's a greater prospect of they're an undercount, although there are scholars who disagree with me on this, mainly the people in Boston at the Steinhardt Center there, Len Sachs and others, who believe that, in fact, the Orthodox are overcounted, which I think is nonsense. We're all 600,000, say 700,000. Be magzim and say 800,000, which seems to me impossible given the age distribution of the Orthodox and what we know about day school enrollment, because say we do have figures about how many kids are in day schools. The past two censuses that I conducted, every single school in North America gave me grade by grade data, and that is a significant achievement. So we're a tiny fraction. I mean, the whole Jewish population of the world, I wrote sometime in the 1950s, was less than a statistical error in the Chinese census. We are now less than a statistical error in the Indian census. And in fact, we're less than half of a statistical error. I mean, there are over a billion Indians. What are we, 13 million? If you go on the campus of Hebrew University, you see the Jewish People's Pump or something. When you go to Sergio Della Pergola, and I'll tell you that every day when you go to bed, there are fewer Jews in the world than there were when you got up. The Jewish population is going down. So 13 million Jews, of which, including Israel and elsewhere, maybe a million and a half or so are Orthodox. And yet, to borrow from an old but famous Pete Seeger folk song, we're all in little boxes that go ticky-tack. And whatever. I mean, gazillions of Muslims and trillions of Catholics and Christians. Do you have ultra-Orthodox Christians or others? But we, for some reason, we put in boxes. And it's a limiting thing. It helps maybe to a degree for scholarly analysis. But essentially, if you look at religious Jewish life, we all exist across a continuum of greater religiosity and lesser religiosity, greater commitment, lesser commitment. But we're part of a certain community, in a sense, a faith community, if you will. And it's one of the hopes that I have that before they send me out to pasture for the last time, that, and the day has come, that we can at least transcend these little boxes, these categories. Even if the categories have validity, again, for sociological study, they don't have validity in real life. They don't. A yeshiva world person in Flatbush can be a person, and is likely to be a person, who went to college, has a professional degree, half the time has a television in his house or her house, dresses in a certain way. And since you've been to Israel, and you know something about the Haredi population here, well, I don't know any Haredim who have televisions. I know quite a few people who fit into the yeshiva world category who go to movies, at least occasionally. I don't know any Haredim who go to movies. I know Haredim who, children who broke away from Haredi life who go to movies. So what does it mean ultra-Orthodox or Orthodox in America? And in Israel, it has a totally different meaning. Doesn't mean very much, and it's used and it's overused. And the important thing for a group like this is that when you have people of commitment and talent and learning and youth and energy and Bezrat Hashem, a future of service in one way or another to Klal Yisrael, that service, that sense of commitment has to try to ignore the categories. You can't ignore them completely, but you're Orthodox, you're religious, you're observant, you're committed to a life of Torah, you're committed to a life of mitzvah, you're committed to a life of giving to others. And that's the crucial thing. It's far more precious. Because when you break into categories, why, they help for analysis. What do? They hurt you in terms of your ability to do something. That person is a modern Jew. This person is a Haredi fanatic. This person has this quality, which is off-putting or allegedly off-putting. What does it serve? How can you take a tiny community of so few neshamas and simply say that we're part of just a small part of that tiny community, and that's where we're going to plant ourselves, and that's where we're going to work. So the idea and the ideal is to try to go away from that. And incidentally, it has another fascinating offshoot. I don't know if I'm wrong in the impression that I get, but I often see fellows from Yisrael Chanan that if they're in a Haredi setting,
that's why you guys.
And the person, why you? Well, I wouldn't have known that. they're in a frumma setting, and someone says, where are you studying? Which yeshiva go to? And where did you get smicha? Where did you learn? Those are questions which, you know, you've all been asked already. I asked it tonight, in fact. Almost teach you. So, you know, the person, if he's in a very firm setting, he's almost apologetic when he says, Reitz, or YU, or Yisrael Chanan. That's terrible. I remember at a good convention, in the 60s, where, lo and behold, one of the feature speakers was Rabbi Bullman, Aloha Shalom. And he got speaker from YU. Well, of course, they couldn't introduce him speaking from Yisrael Chanan or YU, because, you know, they would have, it's Friday night when he spoke, but they still would have found a head to lynch the fellow. So they beat it around the bush, but the word got out that he was from YU. And, well, how did, you know? So some people said, well, he renounced that part of his life. I don't think he did or didn't. I doubt that he did. So it's an important thing to be who you are. We all differ in terms of our approach to certain requirements in our religion. There's certain things that have a remarkable pull on individuals, even very religious people. In the end of the Hilchos Esorah Bia, Rambam, you know, says, and you probably know the language better than I do, that he basically says there aren't two stronger negative forces in life than the taiva for money that people have, chomus, and then for certain sexual behavior. So we're all driven by, we're all different degrees of religiosity, but we're all religious Jews. And it's not for other people to judge who we are. And when you go out and you serve, whether as Chinuch or Rabbanus, or just people who are in other professions, but serving a Kodesh Baruch Hu and Klal Yisrael simply by being good religious Jews, that's who you are. You're Avdei Hashem, you're not Avdei Parim, you're not Avdei of modern orthodoxy, you're not Avdei of centrist orthodoxy, you're not Avdei Haredim. There's nothing in any Shulchan Aruch which changes that. Okay.
I just wanted to ask you about the. On one hand, it feels very overwhelming because we're such a small little. Maybe we're 800,000 Orthodox amongst maybe 13 million Jews amongst billions of people in the world. On the other hand, there's a lot to do. There's a lot of people to help. A lot of people to change. So, if you take a perspective that. So overwhelming. that maybe our job is to just become the best who we can be on our own and not go out and influence other people. Because anyway, we're so limited, we're so small, we're so tiny.
Well, I don't agree with that. I'm not one for beliefs that, you know, you start out by conquering the world. I'll get to that in a minute. An extraordinary saying of Rabbi Amital, which you've probably heard of. No, the Mishnah in Sanhedrin has it right for Orthodox Jews. And even it's talking about physical life, it's also talking about, for us, spiritual life. Matzo nefesh achas. We don't have, in our faith, Billy Graham's. And if you do have a television set, maybe years ago you would see occasionally, there were streams of people, after he finished his mesmerizing sermon, who were making their choices for Christ. Streams of people. Thousands. He would speak to hundreds of thousands, and then they would literally go like a snaking rivers, if you will. Matzal nefesh achas. One person. Can you imagine if you live a lifetime and you save the neshama of one person? That's your whole goal? What you've achieved? One person. Well, yeah. What is it? One person is nothing. And the mission tells us that's kilu hitzu olamali. Save the whole world. You saved the whole world. Now I'll get to what Rabbi Mital said. Rabbi Mital said it is 180 degrees away from something which is quite well known. The statement of the Kutzker Rebbe. The Kutzker said, then who is young, let's say your age, and full of ambition, drive, and hope, and learning, and all the things that are good. So he said that he thought that he would simply change and affect the whole world. The world meant the Jewish world. Have an impact on them. And he went out and he tried to do what he hoped to do, and it was too hard. Much too hard. So he trimmed his sails. And he said, you know, I'll work on my city, then my neighborhood, my community. And all of that was too hard. And he kept on lowering his sights and said, you know, my extended family, that's who I'll save. That's who I'll help. That's who I'll reach out to. That's who I'll be makariv. And that too was hard. Then he said his immediate household. Didn't work very well there. And so he said, at the end of his days, he decided, you know what? My goal in life is to save myself. And he said that was an achievement. Rabbi Mital said the following, that when he was young, he thought that the main thing he wanted to do was to save himself, to better himself, to improve himself. Prove himself again in terms of the mode, what the Torah, Jew, full fidelity to mitzvos, and with midos which are appropriate. That was such a daunting challenge. So he says, you know what, I really can't do very much about myself. I am who I am. So, you know, my B'nai Bayit, that's who the ones I'll work on. That was also very hard. So he went to he reversed the process of the Kutzka. And he ended up saying, you know what the easiest thing for me to do is to save the world. That's a bonus. That's a statement. Such genius. Such genius. That it's easier to set out to save the world than to save yourself. But there's no reason to choose. What I'm simply saying is that for men and for the women, and especially for the women, because one of the changes that is irreversible in Jewish life, and as you know, with Crystal Zip, with Yiddel Zip, whatever happens in the general society affects what happens here, is that the role of women in our religious life, not in terms of panosa, we're going to professions, whatever, but the role of women in our religious life has been substantially enhanced in an enormous number of ways, and that those who harness the capabilities of women, and the Hasidic groups that do that in interesting ways, are the ones that will have a far higher degree of success than those that don't. But at any rate, however you start out, it's to recognize that your challenge is not to choose simply among the different little boxes. Yes, you'll be placed somewhere. Hopefully, this is what the message, one of the messages I gave when I spoke to that group at the Rabbi Lamb's group, is I asked there were about 30 people there, and I asked them, what do you plan to do? I went around the table, because we had several hours, and it was a fun thing. And about two-thirds of the fellows said they're going into chinuch. And maybe a third, probably even less than that, because a few were going to professions, said they'll go into the rabbinate. I said, it's terrible. There's so much you can achieve as a rav and a shul. It's a remarkable thing. I realize that balabatim are balabatim, whatever else, but you can achieve a lot. But whatever you do, it's to try to recognize that you have a mission in life, which is try to help others Jewishly and other ways, and not to be the slave of these categories. I really do, because I'm not at the stage of life where I feel as comfortable as I did when I was young about speaking about myself. At a young age, I was very comfortable about speaking about myself. Too comfortable. I'm not at the stage anymore. Far past it. But at a very early age, I decided to break the boundaries. I decided, in a sense, to do exactly what I just suggested that you consider doing, which is think of the unity of at least the religious community, and not the little boxes in the religious community. I was very close with Aaron Cutler. It was a remarkable relationship. It's a relationship which I never understood, because I got to know him at the age of 17. My Yiddish wasn't particularly good. I wasn't a great Torah scholar. I was on a track to become a great Torah scholar. In fact, he used to go to the yeshiva, take me out of the Beis Medrash, and I would go around with him. And doubtlessly, he thought that Marvin Shig out of the Beis Medrash meant there would be less batola inside the Beis Medrash. There's no question in my mind that that's what he thought. And I went around with him, and he gave me lessons about life and about whatever. And I go to conventions, I ate privately with him. And I mention that because in 1958, he gathered 10 other great Torah luminaries of that generation. And they issued that proclamation, which was really his proclamation, against membership in joint rabbinical bodies with Reform Conservative. There's a whole story about the Rav there, and why the Rav did or didn't, and there's a lot of disagreement about it. I have my own views about it, but whatever. But he asked that. In the 1950s, I was extremely active in Agudas Yisrael. In the 1960s, I remained very active in Agudas Yisrael. But I also became active in the Orthodox Union. I was the only person in the entire Orthodox Jewish experience in America who was about as active a person in Aguda as any other person in Agudas Yisrael, and probably the most active person in the Orthodox Union. And that's an example of how one person can choose to be a devoted to the klal as a klal, and not the prat inside the klal, not a little part of it. I think that's critical. It didn't mean that I violated anything that Rabbi Aaron Cutler taught. In 1969 or so, Rabbi Dr. Samson Rafael Weiss, blessed memory, and unfortunately he's a forgotten figure. He was one of the great minds in the entire American Jewish experience. Of course, he learned in Miri, and elsewhere, but asked me to become an officer of the Orthodox Union, and I refused, because there I felt an officer takes an acharias for an organization, and there I felt there was a barrier in terms of the psak of the Gedolei Torah. But I didn't feel there was a barrier in terms of service. Service has no barrier.
The Orthodox Union? The Orthodox Union?
Yeah.
Why? Because the Orthodox Union
was a member of the synagogue council. And in fact, I recommended Julie Berman. He ended up becoming, that was the start of his great career. Well, perhaps great career, but a career at least in the time. But the important thing is not what I said no to. It's what I said yes to. Menachem, in introducing me, mentioned the presence of Rabbi Jacob Joseph School. It's a voluntary position for 36 years. I'm in my 36th year. We have four schools. Four schools. 1,100 students. Two of them are on Staten Island. What we call that way in Israel, of course. Yeshiva Ketana has a different connotation in Israel than it has in America. But an elementary school yeshiva, one for boys and one for girls. Centrist Orthodox, I guess. In Edison, New Jersey, which is a correction I made, we have a yeshiva gedola. A sifta, base medrash, a small kollel. What is called is a black hat yeshiva. The fellows who go there, at least when they're in the base medrash, not a single one in 26 years has stepped foot in college. I mean,
my brother went there. He
Edison?
Went to college, yeah.
Yeah. Not when he was in Edison.
No, right after Edison.
Yeah, not when he was there. But afterwards, yeah. They can go to college. Well, you know, it's a free country. What was your brother's name?
Moshe Reichman.
Big one?
Moshe Nachanya Reichman.
Signs going up right after he gets
in. No, from Washington
Heights. Washington Heights? All right, we'll call the yeshiva, we'll just rip up his diploma, we'll alter his records, you know, we'll do all those little things, but we can't be blemished. We're very proud that he was on this. But when you're in yeshiva, you don't go to college. When you're in the basement, you don't go to college. That's the point. That's the case. So those are three. What's the fourth school? There's a school called the Jewish Foundation School in Staten Island. It's a co-educational day school. Probably two-thirds of the children are not from Shomer Shabbos homes. RJJ wasn't in the business of educating girls, and certainly not education, co-education. We established 3 years after REITs came into business, into being. They came into business in 1897. We were created at the end of 1899. We opened up really in 1900. We never had a girls' school. We certainly never had co-education. So we have a co-educational day school. I got the blessing of Rav Yisrei and other people to do it. Because the school was going to close, they owed $1.5 million in short-term debt. They couldn't pay any of it. And I couldn't see a school close since there would be no other school that these kids would go to. The other schools would be too front for that. And so I took over the debt, paid down the debt, built a new facility for them, and kept the school open, strengthened the school. So we have the largest enrollment ever this year, close to 450 students. And we maintain it as a co-educational day school. We didn't take it over to make it us. We is that mine? It's mine. Excuse me. Hello? No, tell Yassi that I'm at Gris, talking to the most wonderful group of men and women, and I'll either try to reach them later or tomorrow. Thank you. Okay, thank you. It's the Avichai Foundation America. I don't know how they got this thing. Sorry, folks. But it's an important thing, actually. It's an interesting thing, actually, what the school is about, I think. So at any rate, I got Rav Yisrei's permission to do it. And so the two points there. One is the point which I want to underscore for the sixth time tonight. Your service is the Klal Yisrael. Your service is not to denigrate someone who's less religious than you, or to somehow be off-putting to somebody who at least seem to be front, more front than we are. We're a small community, and it could be done. And I think it's what I've tried to do with my own life. So it's not a case here by urging that you follow a certain path and saying this is a path that was too difficult for me. It wasn't easy for me. I'm not going to say it's easy. It's not easy to be iconoclastic. It's not easy to be iconoclastic. I go to very little meetings. I'm not a member of any organizations anymore because it's too... You have a choice of going to a lot of meetings or to serve a Kodesh Baruch Hu. And that's a choice which I believe. But it's something that could be done. Be done. Don't be afraid. There's a picture of Rabbi Yashiv. I had one long meeting with Rabbi Yashiv. And it was a remarkable meeting. And it's not quite in the same...
What was it about?
...path. I'll get to it.
When was it?
What?
When?
About 6-7 years ago.
How many people were in the room?
Rabbi Yashiv was in the room. Rabbi Fivel Cohen was in the room. He set up the meeting. I was in the room. And I don't know if any of us Shamasim were in the room. Maybe more than 6 years ago, 8 years ago. It wasn't more than that. There was a family in Montreal with a husband, a wife, and two children. The marriage was a brutally bad marriage, and the marriage fell apart. The husband was from Brooklyn, from Borough Park. He went back to Borough Park, refused to give his wife a get. He had two children, a boy and a girl. And there was an extraordinary amount of rancor, even by standards of bitterness that can arise in these situations. So one fine day, he picks himself up. He goes to a shul in Borough Park, which had something of a bezin. It was something of a satma shul, although satma renounced what happened later on. And he comes to the bezin and brings two people with him to serve as edim. And he says to the bezin, actually, he went to Kamara. My daughter's under 12. The Torah says I can marry off my daughter. And I married off my daughter to someone without telling the name. And the three geniuses who were also Diana said, Mekudeshes, Mekudeshes, Mekudeshes. And that's the end of it. So the girl, some years go by. The girl's now 16, 17. And what are you going to do? Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, before he died, verbally said that the girl, that it's not Kedushin. He gave a swear, which was something of a strange swear, which is ain't other Mesa Matzma Russia. And since it's a Mesa Rishis to marry off your minor daughter in this way, so you can't believe the guy. And many other Dolim and Poskim also felt that there should be ways of freeing the girl. But Rav Eliashiv said that it's a Kedushin Gemur, and that's the end of the story. And no other person would go against publicly against Rav Eliashiv. That includes Rav Sternbuch, Rav Rosna, so really outstanding people. So I tried what I could, and I finally decided I had to go see Rav Eliashiv. So Kodesh Baruch Hu was kind to me, and the meeting was when Tzeri Shabbos, Rav Yashiv was rested. And while ultimately there was a huge line of people trying to get in, he gave me close to an hour, and I went at him with my inadequate Yiddish, but I'm sure I was not the first American to speak inadequate Yiddish to him. So he was probably used to Americanized Yiddish. And I gave him Rosh Shlomo Zalman's Svara. And Rav Eliashiv was the funniest thing. He goes with the hand like, Shlema taka gesagt azai. Which means, was Shlema Abach really said this? No, yeah, he said it. And I gave him other svaras, and Rav Eliashiv says to me with a smile, which he's not a smiling guy. Most Gedolim know how to smile. You gotta know. One of the great things, in fact, some of them in America who aren't really such type of people are really considered gedolim because they're terrific and smiling. They're very warm-hearted people. So they're nice. They're cuddly people. They've made up with warmth for what they, you know, because they are not, it's a sad thing. They're the first to acknowledge they're not at the level of the previous generation. So he says to me on several different things that if I was a dying, am I prepared to paskin this way? But anyway, I wouldn't let up. And the essence of my argument was twofold. One is that the Torah does not exist to harm a Jewish girl. And secondly, since there are many cases of marital breakdown with children, you're giving a Pesach, you're giving an opening, you're giving a cue, you're giving instructions for other fathers to do exactly that as a way of getting back at the woman.
Was he used that as leverage? He wanted money?
What? No, he didn't want money. He didn't want to do anything. So all of a sudden, after nearly an hour, Rav Liashiv says, he didn't say I have charata. He says, these were the exact words, ani lo omen lo yisav lo heta. And then he went on to say, other you can rely on other poskim. He withdrew without saying he's withdrawing. He withdrew his issa on this girl getting married, and the girl got married to a very fine person. Why do I mention it? I mention it because it's the second thing. The first thing is, again, break away from the categories. Be courageous enough. Doesn't mean that you'd be wild about it. Think about the opportunities. Not everyone has the same opportunities. But the other thing is that there still has to be some measure of courage. We live as Orthodox Jews within very, very strict boundaries. We live in strict boundaries in two ways. First way, that there are so many behavioral requirements and hashkafic requirements. Every mitzvah in a sense is a prohibition. What you can do with your body, what you can do with your time, what you can do with your means, what you can eat, and whatever else. And not only that, we live with restrictions in the sense that we must accept the discipline of Torah leadership. That's critical for us. And yet, somehow, at least I believe, that when HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave us a mind and gave us capabilities, and he also somehow blessed us with the opportunity of living lives of Torah Jews, as Torah Jews, he did not also tell us that put your brains in mothballs, put your capabilities in mothballs. There were no such instructions. No such instructions. I don't think so. The idea was that we have capabilities. We have the ability to make a difference. Not in the whole world. I don't know that I ever dreamt very, very large. I never dreamt very small either. Hopefully because of some things I've written, maybe when the Torah community, I'll be a footnote somewhere in someone's doctoral dissertation. Or maybe two footnotes, but there won't be very much more. But, you know, I feel very comfortable with my own skin about the fact that, well, to borrow from a Frank Sinatra song, probably his theme song, I did it my way. And it's very important that Kodesh Baruch Hu did not tell us that in areas of life, that everything we do, you have to ask a shayla. The parody of that, of course, is what happens so much apparently in the yeshiva world. You know, do I go to eat here? Do I go to eat there? Do I go to his side? Do I go to my side? What do I do in this situation? What do I do in that situation? Ask any Rosh Yeshiva in America. One of the problems that they have is the fact that Talmidim simply ask the most routine questions of them about life. Our parents never had anyone to ask. They were too busy maneuvering through life. So you have a dual challenge as Orthodox Jews and as people who have what to give to the community, again, men and women, which is to think for yourself. Don't think for yourself in the sense of saying that, you know, I have the right to write my own Shulchan Aruch. I have a right to ignore a psak that's accepted. I have the right to ask a shayla and then to ignore the psak that comes to me. Those are rights that we don't have. And we need not have. The the remarkable thing about a religious life, which too few people have discovered, is the ability to be a Ben Choron at the same time that you're an Eved. To be a Ben Choron at the same time that you're an Eved. Too many of us understandably relish the capacity to be of Avodim. Yeah, we are Avodim to Hashem and to the Torah in a sense, and to the Arabeim, and to the generations that preceded, and to the Shulchan Aruch, and to whatever else. But we're also B'nai Choron. We are free. We are free to think, to decide, to act within the boundaries of the Torah. And the boundaries are far broader than many of us think. And so when you go out into your careers, whatever they may be, into your lives, and people who I look at the dozen or so people here, and I must tell you, I'm inspired. There's a certain kedusha to people like you, and there's kedusha evident in this room. But it's for you to take the challenge, remembering that it's only a matzal nefesh achas. You don't have to conquer the whole world. You don't have to conquer the whole world. All we're asked to do is to live lives of fidelity to Torah, but also fidelity to our own capabilities. I'm going to stop here. I have other things to say, but I think it would be, you know, if there's any discussion or any questions, or else I'll go into other things, but I very much welcome questions or discussion or comments.
Not so much in what you've been talking about now, but more what the evening was billed at. I understand that in the summer yeshivas, the tuition can be somewhere in the range of like $4,000 a year, even less. How do they afford to do that? Whereas in, you know, Central Orthodox, another, you know, thing we aren't able to do that.
Yeah, I heard that you're somewhat of a closet sattler. But anyway, actually, as part of that, it's interesting. If you go to the book, which they published, the Sefer Zikaron for the Satmar Rebbe, the old Satmar Rebbe, who liked me enormously. And if you go in that Sefer, you see that Satmar rallies, there are pictures of me in those rallies. And believe it or not, I wasn't that bad looking then. I'm just a broken down old machine now. But then I would, what? There's some wonderful meisim with the Satmar Rebbe that I have. Satmar Yeshiva is number one. The tuition may be a little higher than 4,000, but the collected tuition is way below that. The Rebbeim, the Satmar Yeshivas, get paid extraordinarily low salaries. I'm talking about $25,000. Satmar is blessed with the fruits of one of the, I don't think I mentioned that, one of the great dialectics in the world. Because on the one hand, no one goes into professional life except those who leave the community. But those who are ambitious and talented are likely to go into commerce. And they have people of significant wealth. At least 30 years ago, I was at this at the annual Satmar dinner, which is the held on the, I forgot something, Kislev, I forgot which one, 10 Kislev, when he was freed. Whatever, there's a Satmar dinner. So I'm sitting there, since I had been in government, I'm sitting there with a whole group of politicians, and they make an appeal at the dinner. And so the first pledge is $1 million, and then they pledges in the hundreds and hundreds of thousands of dollars. And one politician says to the other, "I thought these Hasids were all poor." And they have all that money pouring in. So they live with substantially all philanthropic support. Of course, they save some money by not having secular studies for boys at all. It also violates the New York State education law, but that's a trifling. It's actually an interesting issue, several angles. But they get by largely on philanthropic contributions and paying very low salaries, extremely low salaries. I know Menachem had this thing from Satmar to SKA, Stella K.A. Rance, and I don't know how anyone build that kind of topic
I was just thinking of alliteration of some sort.
Alliteration of some sort.
The question is that if, let's say, modern Orthodox education in, let's say, the tri-state area is 20, I mean, you know the prices, you know the tuition is better, $20,000, $25,000 or even more. I mean, first of all, how can the yeshivas cut that? And what would happen if the kid in the five towns, down the county
board? Most, 10 years ago, I published a study of the financing of Jewish day schools in America. The interesting thing is I had two research assistants. And they both were at Harvard then. And next year, when they remained my research assistants, both were Rhodes Scholars at Oxford. It's really somewhat embarrassing and somewhat limiting that the Talmidim shine above the person who's doing the study. I mean, it took great, great spiritual resources for me to overcome this sense of inferiority that my two research assistants were Rhodes Scholars. But at any rate, I succeeded in overcoming the sense of inferiority. So what did we show? The average day school tuition in America was about $6,000-$7,000 then. Yes, Ramaz charges close to $30,000 now. Heschel in the high school, I don't know, maybe $40,000. I think the economic situation is going to have some impact on some of that. They may have to learn a word which, unfortunately, the very modern schools, the very modern Orthodox schools, and the non-Orthodox schools have trouble with a certain word in the English language. It's called scholarship. And they really don't know what scholarship assistance is. But yeshivas still give scholarship assistance. The yeshivas that get by on $6,000-$7,000 a year, and some get by on $3,000 for dual curriculum. It's an extraordinary thing. Those schools have cut back beyond the point of cutting back. They stint on repairs in the school. They stint on maintenance. They stint on libraries. They stint on office help. You go into the offices of so many of the major yeshivas in America, you'll see two women who are probably geniuses and they can run corporations, handling a school with 500 kids, 700 kids, the record keeping, the phone calls that come in, the kids with the office I want to go home, I'm not feeling well, you have to call my mother. All the things that are coming in now with email, there's a lot more coming in, and the most inadequate in terms of numbers, quantitatively office staffs, qualitatively people who are underpaid or devoted beyond any call of duty, and who keep the ship afloat against great odds. Most yeshivas are underfunded, badly underfunded. There are a handful of schools in the Orthodox community, very known schools, that charge very high tuitions, generally serve a more affluent parent body, and they are at a different wavelength.
What do you think about go ahead, someone should go first.
Yeah, you wanted to ask something, sir.
I just wanted to hear maybe more about the Avichai Foundation.
The Avichai Foundation?
Yeah, just what you do and what it, that they do.
Well, when I figure out what I do, maybe I'll tell you. But what happened is the Avichai Foundation was established about 25 years ago, a little over 25, by Zalman Bernstein, Sanford Bernstein. Sanford Bernstein was a person who came from a Jewish family, obviously. He was not raised religiously. There was some tradition in his household. And he went to France, for whatever reasons, married a non-Jewish woman. Came back here, had two children with her. And obviously, halachically not Jewish. And established a company called Bernstein & Company, which is now a subsidiary of a French company. They bought him out after he died. He was a character. When he established the company, he had been a stock analyst, whatever else, for Oppenheimer Company. When he established his company, he took out full-page ads in the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal. The ads had a single word as its text: Bernstein. Amazing. And he had this mishigas of something green, the color green. If you ever deal with any of the reports that Avichai, they're all green covers. He would say the color of money. So Bernstein. And he became very successful. And then his father died, and he was looking for a place to say Kaddish. He went to Rabbi Riskin's shul, Lincoln Square, and Rabbi Riskin, and he couldn't read Hebrew. He didn't know any Hebrew. And Rabbi Riskin was mekarev of him, and ultimately established the Avichai Foundation. Originally, the Avichai Foundation focused only on America, and it focused only on Orthodox activities and essentially Kyrev activities. 20 years ago, I was asked to evaluate certain Kyrev programs that they did fund. There were dreadful programs, and I wrote that, and that led to my own relationship ultimately coming to the foundation, where I don't work at the foundation. I do a lot of other things, obviously, but I am senior advisor to the foundation, and I have a role in a lot of the things that they do, and in a sense, it's a rewarding relationship. Ultimately, they decided, the trustees of Avichai decided that, and I'm not a trustee, that in order for them to achieve their mission, which in America was to bring Jews closer to Judaism, they would have to involve the non-Orthodox communities. After all, 90% of American Jewry is not Orthodox. So how can you have a thing? And so they decided to expand their activities and to become involved in reform and conservative activities as well. Interestingly enough, at that time I went to Rav Elia Svei, who I regard as a person I felt that I could ask him, you know, as to whether I should continue my association with Avichai. I clearly expected the answer would be no, because after all, he's the Kanoi of the Rosh Yeshivas. And Rav Elia Svei said to me, Geh Sveg by Svetens, which means go ask someone else. Truth of the matter is, I find it difficult these days to ask anyone else in America, but certainly when he was functioning, I couldn't ask anyone else. So months later, I'm together with him at a simcha, and I go with him again, and he says someone in terror, and I ask him again, and he says, I asked him, should I stay with Avichai? And he says, I told you to ask someone else. Well, I didn't ask someone else. So an additional period of time went by, and we were at a wedding, and I went over to him, and I said, Rosh Yeshiva, I have this question I have to ask you about. Avichai is giving money to non-Orthodox things. Am I permitted to continue involved in Avichai? So he says very agitatedly, I told you to ask someone else. So whereupon I said to him something as follows, I think I'm pretty close with elections. I said, Heinte Gedele Torah, today's Torah leaders. They fear in Klai Yisrael by Zog and Gefeng by Tzvetens. Their leadership is to say, ask someone else. I said, is Dos Agadol the Torah? They told me to ask someone else. You're supposed to be someone. So he laughed. I think that was a pretty nice thing to tell him. I mean, but you know, you got to tell, you know, you got to be independent, you know. So if they hit you, you know. But what do you mean? So he said, no, he said to me very, very strong. He says, there's no question by him, and I should stay, and I stayed, and whatever, and I evolved. And today I scored an enormous thing in the budget cuts, etc., which is that one of the things I have, and I have a $50 million fund to give interest-free loans for Jewish day school construction, yeshiva day school construction. Not many Orthodox schools, most of the money goes to Orthodox schools, because 80% of day school enrollment in the United States is Orthodox. And the schools are having trouble repaying, and at a cost which will cost Avichai about $500,000, we agreed, we have to work out details, that's why this call came through, I think, in America, to reschedule the loans, so that over the next couple of years, they only pay back half of what they're supposed to pay back under their agreement. And Avichai does a lot of good in North America. When Zalman Bernstein died about 10 years ago, he left $1.3 billion to charity, to tzedakah. I don't know if anyone's done that kind of thing. It's a lot of money. And that's Avichai's program here. Avichai's program in Israel is not as attractive to me. It's mostly to bring Jews of different religiosity together. You may have seen their symbol called Tzav Pius, which is a strange kind of symbol. I don't think it works. I've limited substantially my work for Avichai in Israel because I'm not happy with the program. The main thing I'm doing now, I'm the only non-Israeli who's on the steering committee of the Gutman research. Every 10 years, there was a great social scientist called Louis Gutman. He developed a sociological scale called the Gutman scale to measure opinion. And he made Aliyah around 1948. He established the Gutman Institute. They do a lot of survey research. And every 10 years, sponsored by Avichai, they do a study of the Israeli Jews. It's a major study of Israeli Jews, their practices and beliefs. And so on the steering committee of that. You had a question.
What is it?
Yeah.
What did you want
to? Just in terms of like talking in terms of the day school, things like that. So there's a big discussion about the tuition crisis. And one of the things that I heard recently was that some people feel that maybe one of the answers is technology. It's a lot of like distant learning and things like that. Cause I want to know what you feel about that.
It's funny that I'm going to answer the question. I was married 46 years ago, a little more than 46 years ago. Which was a pretty old age, but I had to wait for my wife to grow up because she's almost 10 years younger than me. And I met her when I was going for my doctorate and I was teaching at Breuer's in Washington Heights. You know the story?
No, I don't know the story.
Did you go there?
Elementary school.
I was teaching actually 7th and 8th grade and also the high school which I just established. And she was in the 9th grade, and when she was in the 9th grade, I decided that we were going to get married. Malka Schicks says repeatedly that they arrest people these days for these things, but I don't know, but it's a little scary. But at any rate, it's very true. We got engaged the night she graduated high school. I was teaching at YU then. And when she got her diploma, Rav Schwab, Zichrono Livracha, said to the other girls, they're all going out to college, we get their bachelor's degree 4 years from now, you're getting a bachelor tonight. The next day, he outlawed single male teachers. And this is true. Malka Schicks has been saying for 46 years that he was a day too late. It's really terrible. But at any rate, so we married, to her regret. She came from the West Side. We moved into Borough Park. I said it's only temporary. Well, 46 years was still later, and she wants to know what's grounds for divorce to bring a wife from the West Side to Borough Park. But at any rate, so we had this a single bulb. There was a fixture around a bulb like this. Single bulb with a fixture, three screws around the middle. And she asked me, the bulb was out, if I can change the bulb. So I unscrew this little mini fixture, take out the bulb, put in a new bulb, screw it back. And about 10 minutes later, she walked by and the whole thing came crashing down. Mr. Baruch Hashem, and the other good Baruch Hashem is the last time she has to do anything, except what remains the major function in the household of a Jewish male, which is take out the garbage. That is something which Jewish men must do. It's a whole long tradition. I say this because I'm asked a question about technology. I've never driven a car. I don't know how to drive a car. I decided as a young age I wasn't going to drive a car, and I've never touched a computer in my life. Although I send maybe 100 emails a day. I've never touched a computer. I don't know how to turn on a computer. My daughter says I once tried to turn on hers and I ruined that computer. But she's not trustworthy. But
you have a blog.
At any rate, distance learning has been tried. I've advocated, Avichai has made grants for distance learning, some involving teachers in Israel, today schools in America. There's Yesterday I got from the Avichai office a huge packet, Avichai office in Jerusalem, a huge packet consisting of about 60 applications for a grant. The applications share a common denominator, which is as follows. I said before that 40% of day schools in North America have 100 or fewer students. This impacts substantially on what they can achieve. Some of this has to do with geographic diversity, much of it has to do with ideological, theological diversity. More of it has to do with the fact that, particularly at the high school level, there are people who are of ambition, whatever else, who go and open up their own candy schools called a Beis Yaakov, a yeshiva, whatever else. And I don't say this to criticize it. But at any rate, I got Avichai to agree to fund a certain number of projects where several day schools, two or more day schools in the community, will enter into joint cooperative ventures. I just got, as I said yesterday, the proposals that came in, almost 60, which is an enormous number, because each consists of two or more schools cooperating, and the single largest cooperation is in technology, where they indicated each is too small, too inadequate financially, whatever else, to do what it can do. Having said that, there's ferment and whatever else, but I fully agree with you. The somehow, someone has to bite the bullet and really do bold things in the area of technology and Torah education at the day school level. So I agree with you. But there are things that have happened. There's some progress. Menachem's cousin works for Avichai. She sent me an email. She gets a mazel tov, as you know. And she is an expert on technology, and we're trying to accomplish certain things. Other foundations are working in the same area.
So you believe that we'll cut the costs of day school education, meaning the cost of building and teachers and...
Day schools are underfunded. Leaving out the Ramazes and a few other schools, the Heschels and whatever the world. Day schools are unbelievably underfunded. Teachers are underpaid. And they're often not paid on time. And they don't have the benefits, the pension benefits, the health benefits, which they need. In a typical Beis Yaakov elementary school in America, a girl can start teaching a year or two after seminary at $6,000 a year. So it's not a question of how you save money. The schools are already subsidized, in a sense, by their faculty. Almost every single yeshiva, almost every single Beit Yaakov in America is subsidized by its faculty. And they if anything, they should do spending more, but it's not going to happen. For example, it's no great revelation to you that given sociological or socio-psychological conditions, there are a lot of children who need help, who need counseling, who need someone to be with them. There's, whether it's family breakdown or whatever else that happens in the general society, penetrates our walls as high as the barriers may be, or we think they may be. And the kids who really are in pain, emotional pain, whatever else. How many schools have adequate counseling staffs? At least Haredi schools, you can count them on the fingers of a mutilated hand, how many have. Go to a Beis Yaakov. Go to a Beis Yaakov and you see a teacher making $6,000 a year who holds the hands of a little girl and is talking to the family at night, and she's still only making $6,000 doing her lesson plans. So they're underfunded. Go into many of the yeshivas and you see what maintenance looks like. Go to the libraries. Go to the rudimentary computer rooms that they have. And you'll see, well, look at it this way. In New York State and New Jersey, California is different, and I don't know why, but California is different. In New Jersey and New York State, where, so far as I know, the public schools only have a single curriculum, secular studies, the average cost per student, full-time a year, is about $15,000 per student. We have dual curriculums. The average cost is under $10,000, significantly under $10,000. So I'm being somewhat soft in my reaction, because when I speak about day school education, I'm so frequently asked the question of why aren't they really, don't they have too many staff? Aren't they wasting money? Where can't we really cut back? Baloney.
It's day school, it's yeshiva. Which segments of the community are you talking about?
I'm talking about whether it's Solomon Schechter schools, whether it's community day schools, whether it's Haredi schools. There are a small number of schools that service a very affluent parent body, which in many ways, in terms of their staff structure, they'll have a, for example, you go to Heschel High School which is this very fancy community high school, which is close to $40,000 a year tuition. They'll have a guidance counseling staff just for college admission. They'll have several people working on that. So you can say in those schools they have adequate staffs, or maybe more than adequate, but the ordinary school, overwhelmingly the schools are underfunded. All schools, across the board, they're underfunded. They're underfunded only because if a teacher can be there his or her whole life and not have a pension plan. That's also part of underfunding. It's underfunding not to have a library. Not to have a library fully stocked with networking computers that can access a whole series of materials, which at least at the high school level could be critical to the kids. How many schools purchase the material which is keeps the students up to date? There are far many more schools that literally don't have libraries or nothing to speak of. Yeah, someone in the community died, and there were books in the house, and the kids, when they were cleaning out the house and seeing what they can get from the bank account, said, well, you know, there's a local Jewish school here. They were religious Jews. Let's take mom and pop's the old books. When I became president of RGJ, it was the funniest thing. They had boxes, hundreds of them, of books that had been cleared out, Sidurim, whatever else. I'll tell you why I hired, actually. This is amazing. What's his name? Who died so young. It was extraordinary. What was his first name? Kaplan.
Aria
Kaplan. I got a grant from Congress of $10,000. This is roughly 1976 or so, 75, to go through all of the books. We found some gems, you know, old sperm that were rare, whatever else. And the others, I worked out an arrangement with a cemetery to bury, I don't know, tens of thousands of books. People had simply left it there because it was the path of least resistance for them to do that. Schools are terribly underfunded. Terribly. And the salaries are indecent. They're worse than Israel. Do I have to tell you about this process in Israel where anyone who teaches at a seminary has to figure out how much time it takes to go from place A to B and then from B to C, C to D? Is it that uncommon for people in Chinuch in Israel to be in three different schools? It's not uncommon. You think the people are doing it because, I want to set the all-time record for how many schools I can be in a single day? No, they do it because even with going to three schools or four schools, whatever else to do, they can barely have ends meet. We haven't come close to understanding it. And I don't say this critical of people. It is an extremely expensive thing to chinuch is very expensive. It's very expensive. And if to really do it well, it's expensive. To have tutorial systems, to have systems. I mean, you go into schools and they have remediation, which what do they call that room where they have remediation?
Resource room.
Yeah, so you got a resource room and you see the mora there and they have two kids in the room, three kids in the room. It's rudimentary. Can hardly do the job. But the money isn't there.
Do you have any suggestions?
Everybody, what?
Do you have any suggestions to fix the problem?
Well, I would have suggestions if the economy had not nosedived. I mean, a very important thing is for schools to have endowments. And while it's impossible, very difficult for a new school, it's not as difficult for older schools. And the ways of developing endowments. My second year as president of the Rabbi Jacob Joseph School, we owed a lot of money. The school had collapsed on the Lower East Side. And we sold our property on the Lower East Side to Chinese for $170,000. And we still owed way more than that. And the board said, we'll use the $170,000 to pay off its debt. I wanted the money to be put into the start an endowment fund. And I said, we'll work off the debt as we can. And the board voted against me, and since my deal with the Rabbi Jacob Joseph School was that I shall never get paid a salary check from the yeshiva, and that's been true for 36 years, so I picked myself up and said, gentlemen, only man on the board, of course, I can't help that, and I said, it's been a privilege for me to be president for a year and a half of the Rabbi Jacob Joseph School. You've decided against the path that I think is necessary. So I resigned immediately, and I got up to leave, and they said, no, we changed our vote. So they changed our vote. We established an endowment, and my yeshiva's Those four schools live largely off the endowment. So that's one thing that might be done. More sophistication in fundraising, by which I mean there's so much silly fundraising. You know, you get these letters.
Like events and big events?
No, I'll get to that. You know,
actually, within the next 5 minutes, though.
What?
Well, within 5 minutes.
5 minutes, what?
Yeah.
We have five more minutes?
We have 5 more minutes.
So what was your question? Big events? No, I wanted to say on fundraising. Person to person, if you're going to do fundraising, you're going to go into Cloudwork to do fundraising. Don't think about sending an expensive gift, even if it's Art Scroll. Nelson, I really meant that, by the way. And it's all face-to-face. You know, you mentioned technology. So you get from, you even at your tender ages, you get fundraising letters. Dear friends, you know, we're writing on behalf of the 2,000 orphans who attend this school, and the letter writes itself, and it doesn't resonate in any way. Well, this technology is computers. So you put your mailing list on computers, okay? And you send, instead of a letter, dear friend, you send to Rabbi and Mrs. Fried, okay? And then you sign the letter. It could be done. My list consists of 2,500 names. Many of them are in the cemetery because you can't. I try to keep the list, but many aren't. Every single letter, my Rosh Hashanah letter, I know this sounds crazy, but it's true. Every single letter is signed personally by me, is personally addressed. Every single letter gets a handwritten note on the bottom. Bad thing about that is that even as a boy, my handwriting was illegible. So every year I get, apart from getting a lot of donations, frankly, I get a slew of letters which say one thing and another say another. One bunch of letters say, the president of this yeshiva is illiterate, and I will not support a yeshiva that has an illiterate as president. Please take me off your mailing list. This is true. I'm not making this up. But HaKadosh Baruch Hu in his infinite goodness puts into the neshamas of Jews another instinct. And I get the second batch of letters saying, the Rabbi Jacob Joseph School has an illiterate as president. You certainly must be desperate. Please accept my contribution.
So I have a question about communal triage. What would you list the top for the two, three things?
I know, of course, triage is. But first of all, if any group, if you go to the rabbinate, go into the rabbinate. There's so much to be done. There's so much to accomplish. It's more rewarding financially than chinuch, actually, believe it or not. And it's more rewarding in terms of what you can accomplish. Chinuch is very rough, very, very rough in terms of finances. It's very rewarding in terms of children. But you should only do it if you love what you're doing. Chinuch is a terrible thing if you don't love what you're doing. And if you love what you're doing, you can do it for a very long time. Who here was from Los Angeles again? I asked him about my first grade Rebbe. My first grade Rebbe died a year ago. His name was Rabbi Nachman Mandel. His brother is Rabbi Mandel, who died already on the Yeshiva Brooklyn. Rabbi Nachman Mandel taught the first grade, if you're sitting, say sitting, taught first grade for 70 years. 70 years. He was my first grade Rebbe. He was my first grade Rebbe when I was 9 years old. I was in the first grade, we moved to Kodesh 9 years old. 9 years old to be in the first grade at the Rabbi Jacob Joseph School. And my twin brother was with me. And that was a circumstance that came about. I'll get to triage, I hope. Because my father died suddenly 71 years ago on Purim. And my mother was left with four children. He was a Rav during the Depression, and he died penniless. And I did not live at home for the next 5 years. And I was in public school. And I came to yeshiva at the age of 9 in the fourth grade, in secular studies in the first grade, whatever, and I was an awful person. I mean, I was wild and untamed, and unfortunately, that, you know, you get old and you become tame, but I was really wild, etc. But this was the most beautiful Rebbe one could imagine. When he was retired after 70 years, so I couldn't go out to Los Angeles to speak, so they take my speech. And I told them something that happened in Los Angeles about a dozen years ago. My twin brother, who's the world's leading expert on government budgeting, was in Los Angeles, and I was in Los Angeles. We were both there for separate reasons. And we went to that good shul in Hancock Park, we were near Hancock Park. And Rabbi Mandel was in shul. And he grabbed us out, the two of us. I had seen him over the years a number of times. He did, you know, something of halakha, I'm not kissing someone in shul because, child in shul, because it shows it's a great order in the Kodesh Baruch. So he took us aside, and he kissed us, each of us. And I said, Rebbe, I have a problem. He said, what's the problem? I said, it's a report card you gave me. And he laughed, and he said, in Yiddish, mekenes mesaken zayin. Which of course means we can fix it. And so I said at that speech, which was taped in Los Angeles, that's the only motto that someone should have in Chinuch on a child, Mekenes Masakin Zayin. But if you love that, and you reach that level of looking at a Jewish child, or any child, if you're teaching non-Jews as well, in fact, and you say, Mekenes Masakin Zayin, that can be fixed, or at least I want to fix it. Then you've reached the epitome of what it is to teach. So of course, there's that great mysterious mixture of spirituality, of knowledge, of love, of everything that elevates and makes for a great teacher. And that's who this person was. As far as triage, I don't know. There's so much to do. I have very mixed feelings about Kiruv, and this is the last thing I'll say, Kiruv activity, because too often it is disconnected from Chinuch. Too many people in the Kiruv spend almost all of their time either publicizing what they're doing or fundraising. And whereas in Chinuch, what you're doing basically is educating kids. If Chinuch is attached to Kiruv, it's great. Kiruv is functional. If not, I've had some reservations about it. But particularly for those of you who might not go into any ordinary profession, which is Jewish, whether chinuch or the rabbinate, then the learning that you have, the goodness that is in you, and all that other talents that you bring to bear, if you can bring it to bear in individual situations of either adult education, volunteering in some programs, teaching with people, one-on-one, chavrusa arrangements, men and women, that's also something that's just very valuable. There's so much to do. The day is short, as we learn in Parak, and the malacha is so great, so enormous. We're a small community, as I said an hour or so ago, but there's so much to be done. But don't think that you have to conquer the whole world. Matzel nefesh achas, one life, you've saved the whole world. Thank you, I'm honored to be here. I really am.
Thank you very much.